I think entrepreneurs are always defined by a class of people that take advantage of the environment they're thrown into. And I think the same rule applies when the pandemic is on.
Tim Galeri, managing partner at Sierra Ventures, knows all too well the journey and evolution of successful entrepreneurs. Over his 18-year career in venture capital, as well as being a former serial entrepreneur himself, he inherently understands those critical traits aspiring and current entrepreneurs need to possess to build businesses that thrive.
And, one of the key attributes of being a great entrepreneur or an elite entrepreneur is the flexibility and the speed by which you adapt. And so I think you're seeing the best entrepreneurial teams do just that.
So what else does it take to be that great entrepreneur, break through the noise, and create a sustainable business during these unusual times? Welcome to Strategic Momentum, the pod course with actionable tips, inspiring stories, and practical advice from progressive leaders on what it takes to break through business and career inertia and understand the business of work. I'm your host, Connie Steele. Happy New Year, and thanks so much for listening to our first episode of 2021. Unfortunately, we are still in the midst of the pandemic, but these trying times have also led to an increase in entrepreneurial activity and opportunities. There's been a surge in creativity, and people, as well as companies around the world, have come up with new ways to respond to existing or emerging needs. According to a Wall Street Journal analysis, Americans are starting new businesses at the fastest rate in more than a decade. The Foundation for Economic Education even cites that the pandemic offers a moment ripe for creative destruction. And that's certainly not surprising for Tim Galeri, who has been knee-deep in the startup world for much of his career. Yet, he didn't set out to be an entrepreneur. In fact, it was his curiosity and desire to always be trying that led him down the path of expanding his skill sets, experiences, and ultimately his career. Let's learn more about his journey.
I grew up in India. My dad was in the army, and my mom was a homemaker, and I got my technical degrees in India. And the transition to the US was to come follow my passion and in doing an advanced degree. And I was into robotics at the time, so I came to do my master's industrial engineering and robotics. And the lessons that I sort of remember through my childhood, my dad was in the army, so working hard and putting in a good day's work was something that always stayed with me. And my mom, interestingly, was one that used to push us in all kinds of different directions to try different things. And when I came to the U.S., I sort of was struck by the entrepreneurial spirit in the U.S. And the minute I finished my master's, one interesting event that sort of led me to California, which is kind of where I started my professional career, was that I was on a scholarship, but the scholarship got taken away because of some funding issues. And I had to fend for myself and figure out where I'm going to get the tuition for the next semester. And I ended up going to the student union and pulling one of those tabs, and ended up with a job selling books door to door in Sacramento in 107 to 110 degree heat with a 40-pound bag on my back.
And it happened to be more religious oriented books, if I
that is correct. The book was half Bible and half sort of math and sciences, and here's a Indian kid selling books door to door in Sacramento. I enjoyed it a lot. It was tough, but I learned that one could learn how to sell door to door. And that experience has always stayed with me. Then after that, I finished and came to California and got into technology, and I haven't left since.
That summer was transformative for Tim as he learned a core skill that has been so fundamental to his career success, yet wasn't something that he formally went to school for or even knew he had a talent in early on. He, in fact, was so good at selling that he made Quota Club, that top group of achievers. But reaching that pinnacle wasn't easy, as 90% of the time, he had to deal with rejection. But his work ethic and persistence helped him push through, and he learned to successfully convert those conversations into sales. After graduating from school, Tim got a job at a semiconductor company, which was more in line with his academic background. However, as someone who is naturally curious, it wasn't surprising when the entrepreneurial bug eventually hit him, as Tim shares.
What's also interesting when I came to California was that I came to work at this company called LSI Logic that made computer chips, but I fell into this entrepreneurial conversation that happened on the weekend. And I kind of always had this, you know, why not me? I mean, I can make this happen as well. So that led me to join this company called Scopus Technology, where I was employee number 6 in 1992. And I came in engineering, then I went into sales and marketing. And ultimately, we took the company public in 95 and sold it to another public company called Siebel Systems for $800 million. And as I was at Siebel, I lasted a couple of weeks because I had this just burning desire to start my own company and be a CEO because it was possible. Everybody else was doing it, so why not me, right? So I did that. I just launched into it with a few folks that I knew from Scopus. That business, we grew about $50 million. And as things happen in life and certainly in this business, opportunity knocks when you make it possible, you know, for opportunity to knock. And I remember in 1999, we were thinking about taking the company public and we got an inbound and one thing led to the other and ultimately ended up selling that business to a public company called Epiphany for nearly a little over $3 billion, $3.2 billion. From there, I transitioned into venture capital in 2002. But the common theme in all of these is this notion that kind of always be trying. So always push yourself into an area that you may not be comfortable with, but believe that you'll figure it out, right? That has been the common theme in my career. And if you look back, I've really, really had 3 jobs out of college. First one at Scopus, then at Octane, and now Sierra. I've been here since 2002. But the 3 seminal rules that I follow, always be sweating. So ABS, which is, you know, work hard. ABL, which is always be learning, which is have a super curious mindset. And ABT, which is always be trying something new. And I think those have been the common themes through my career.
Well, you know what would be helpful too, is if you could give just a quick overview of Sierra Ventures for those who may not be familiar with your venture capital firm.
Yes. Yeah, happy to do that. So Sierra is in its 38th year of operation. It was started by one of my mentors and close friends, Peter Vendel. And I joined the firm, as I said before, in 2002 as a general partner. And the firm, from its inception, has been focused on early stage venture capital. So we like to be the first money in to support these amazing entrepreneurs. We're also very focused on B2B. So we don't do consumer tech. You know, we focus on the B2B side of the business. And this means both small businesses and large businesses, what are the technologies and infrastructure they need to succeed? The philosophy of the firm is come early, stay late. So the idea being that one needs to have patience and one needs to have gumption. One needs to have, be willing to support the entrepreneurial team through the most definitely what are going to be ups and downs to build a business over time. And the fourth one is building a business with fundamental valuable metrics. So we're not momentum investors. We tend to be very much being ex-operational folks. You know, we build real businesses. So I joined the firm in 2002, and it's a tough business to learn because there is no, you know, book you can read and say, here's you know, VC 101 and go for it. You kind of have to make mistakes as you go through the journey yourself. And hopefully you make less mistakes and more better bets and ultimately survive and thrive. So that was my journey from 2002 to 2010. And then 2010, I repotted myself back to my earlier point inside Sierra. So I had an opportunity to take over the firm from Peter Wendell, who retired, along with my two partners, Mark and Ben. And so from being a general partner in the firm, I actually was one of the principals in the firm. And then, you know, we raised Fund 10, Fund 11, and now Fund 12 just before COVID hit in this February in 2020. And, you know, we're taking the firm forward. So we're fortunate that we have great limited partners that trust us with their money. And they've been partners for going on 4 decades now, and the entrepreneurs that boomerang back to us, and a great set of ecosystem partners that, you know, put money behind us. So can't be more happy. I was telling my wife yesterday over dinner that it doesn't feel like I've worked a day in my life. I have so much fun being a venture capitalist.
Tim has always had a growth mindset. He grew up in a home environment where he was encouraged to explore various things and not be afraid to fail. In fact, he did theater, played soccer, and even entered a singing contest versus being singularly threaded towards academics. And these lessons he learned in his youth have been a critical part to his approach to life and business.
I look back at the lessons of kind of parenting that my parents fostered on me, have stayed with me and taught me, is that contrary to popular belief, you don't have to be excellent in everything, okay? You obviously have to be very, very good at a few things that you're going to be basing your career on or your interest in. But I think it's okay to be good enough at a bunch of things, because that ends up, you know, you end up living a lot more richer life. The way I think about my experiences as a child now is, in a way, that's what my parents fostered, that try a bunch of things. You learn enough that you'll start enjoying them. But the fact that you have this innate ability to jump into something, learn enough and then, you know, be very comfortable in failing, because that's what happens when you try new things. I think the ability to be okay with failure and be able to pick up and go after you fail is the skill one learns when you try many, many things. And I feel that, in this age of, you know, kind of hyper focused parenting, where you kind of push the kid to on a single axis, I think may not be the best strategy. And certainly in my case, it wasn't. So I'm much more of a sort of a all-rounder. And I think it's a more fulfilling and fun life. Let's put it that way.
Would you say that you're very much a parallel pather?
I am. And then I think it also sort of, you know, by virtue of doing these things, you tend to develop your left brain, right brain skills. And I think to be successful in business, where you're dealing with a very imperfect set of situations and people, I think those skills come to really help you in ways that you don't see them when you're actually developing them in your earlier years.
And so this development of really both that right brain and left brain side, where you're kind of establishing the whole brain, how would you say all of those experiences, comprehensive experiences that you've had, shape the way you approach your own VC business, as well as the businesses you support and invest in at Sierra?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Connie, I think, you know, when I think about the VC sort of business, you know, one of the things that after you figure out the kind of the three tenets of, you know, investing in venture capital, obviously, is that the space has to be large enough. So, you know, one of the tenets we hold very close to ourselves at Sierra Ventures is that, you know, large companies are built in large markets. So, you know, we get a lot of conviction around the directionality of the market and the idea. So that's one. The next ingredient is actually people, which is, you know, the CEO, the founding team, the interaction between them, and, you know, how does that whole equation work? And then the final, obviously, is the execution, which is, you know, every market that is great has competition, and how would this team do in a competitive sort of landscape? So I feel that the analysis of the market is, you know, more of a kind of left brain function, because that's all, you know, very obvious. All the data is there. But the analysis of the team and having a better sense of, you know, which is the team that'll finally be able to run the marathon, I think very much is a right brain exercise. And it's those two that really help us sort of, I think, evaluate and get the best investments in the fund. In the second part, which is the right brain exercise, the kind of things that we try to go underneath the cover of, you know, the skills and the background of the founders is, can these guys or gals deal with failure, and are they flexible in the way they think about, you know, building a great business? You have to constantly be reinventing yourself as an entrepreneur, and you also have to be constantly reinventing yourself as a general partner in the venture firm, because I can tell you through the 18 years I've been at Sierra, the market has shifted multiple times, right? And so the technical skills that I possessed when I came in are different than today. And had I not been intellectually interested to go deep and understand what's going on, I think you tend to sort of, you know, your tool tends to get dull. So I think my answer to your question would be, on the one hand, this right brain, left brain helps in the best deals getting chosen. And on the other hand, for the fund to sustain its edge, the partners, me and my partners included, have to have that, you know, curiosity and the fact that it's okay to fail, because we as investors also fail. You know, as early stage venture, a large percentage of the dollars don't work, right? So there's also that element of being able to pick up and go, even though the last experiment did not work out.
I know one of the other important mantras that you have, and let's couple this with that theme and what Sierra stands for, come early, stay late, but yours is so much about your perspiration.
Yes.
Not just inspiration.
Yes. The kind of people I deal with on a daily basis, being a venture capitalist, these are wonderfully bright people, all many with multiple degrees. These are wonderfully driven people, the glass half full people that walk through the doors at Sierra. So I'm, you know, my sampling is of the best of the best, right? These are entrepreneurs that have already self-selected into that elite category of people that want to push forward with business ideas. When I have to choose between that amazing set of individuals and which are the ones that I want to back versus not, the difference I see in the ones that truly perform versus that don't is this notion of respiration versus inspiration, which is the idea that you wake up every day and you put in your hours of work. So I guess the point I'm making is it's not important enough to be super bright and super insightful about a sector that you're building a company in, because that's a table stakes feature to be an elite entrepreneur. What you need to have in addition is this regimen and the fact that you put in work on a daily basis. And I think that's what really, you know, helps you succeed as an entrepreneur. So the perspiration versus inspiration kind of balance is something that I feel has benefited me. And so I tend to look for that skill. And I test for that during the courting process with an entrepreneur, because it's when you send them an email, how quickly are they responding? Are they 24/7? Are they prepared mind? You know, when you ask them for a pipeline or, hey, send me operating plan for 2021, what comes back and how quickly? And it's that prepared mind, always on personalities that really thrive in this, you know, pretty competitive business to be an elite entrepreneur.
Having worked across multiple functional roles, Tim was able to gain a comprehensive view of how an organization functions, which was incredibly valuable. Further, his nonlinear experience, taking on both right brain and left brain oriented functions, is what he sees as being vital to entrepreneurs today.
So just to set the context, I just got my green card. Scopus was an ad in the local San Jose Mercury News that I responded to, looking for, you know, an engineer and in Berkeley. And I used to live in San Jose, so I just jumped in my car and went to meet the CEO. There were like, you know, four guys in a conference room kind of writing code. And I joined them as an engineer in 92. One of the things that I still tell entrepreneurs and, you know, folks that generally ask me for advice is that one of the benefits of working in an early stage company is that you're so close to the road that you feel every bump, right? Like in every function you're in, there is no shock absorber, right? So if there's an issue with a customer or there's an opportunity, everybody knows it and everybody learns from it. So the idea that you can start in a function, say engineering, which I did, and I was a reasonably good engineer, but I also loved customer conversation. So the CEO said, hey, why don't you go into sales engineering, which is then I went that next, and then into sales. And then I was about to leave Scopus after we'd gone public, and my CEO said, hey, you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur and CEO, you got to learn how to do product management and marketing. So I spent another year as VP of marketing. Now, it was my live MBA. So I learned every function possible from 92 to 95 and change. But that rounded off my ability to be able to see how the whole organization functioned. Different than if I'd just gone to IBM and worked in the marketing department. I would never know what selling is and what, you know, forecasting looks like and what, how does product roadmaps, how do they connect to the actual, you know, customer selling side, and how does the finance function work? So that's the benefit of you know, working in an early stage company, and you're in such intimate quarters with every function that instead of one guy, you know, pulling on the tusk of the elephant and the other guy grabbing the leg, you can actually see the whole elephant, right? And that experience at a young age is what makes phenomenal entrepreneurs, and I highly recommend. And of course, I'm massively biased because I live in the world and thrive in the world of early stage companies. But I think for a young budding entrepreneur to be, or somebody that wants to learn how to be a well-rounded exec, a well-run company where you'll be given those opportunities is actually the best thing you can do early in your career.
So talking about entrepreneurship, how has entrepreneurship changed over time, and particularly during the pandemic?
Yeah, so this is a great question. You know, I think the biggest change has been that, you know, what I call sort of linear, you know, pathing, or, you know, learning as an entrepreneur, which is certainly what I went through, and I'll explain what that is, to kind of parallel pathing, right? So when I was an entrepreneur and I was in my kind of late 20s and going into my 30s, every skill that had to be learned to be a CEO had to be done sequentially, A after B after C after D. And the reason was the only way to learn what had to be done in engineering was to be an engineer. And then you went into sales and you learned what selling was. And then you went, so you had to kind of quote unquote put in the time, right? So it took you like a decade to actually truly learn all the edges of the functions that you needed to learn to be a great, you know, all-round, well-rounded exec. Today, if you have, back to my ABL, always be learning mindset, right? And you really are thirsty for knowledge, you can actually parallel path or parallel track the learning, because everything is available on the internet, in YouTube videos, in these amazing podcasts done by Connie, right? And so on and so forth, right? If you have the urge to learn, you will find the time to learn and educate yourself. So consequently, what's happening is elite entrepreneurs are actually coming out with all those skills much younger. So, you know, people say, wow, how, you know, that kid is just 28 and I can't believe how amazingly well-rounded is. That's because these are the parallel pathers. These are the people that want to learn and want to be the best, and they put in the time, right? And the, you know, the ABS, the always be sweating aspect of things, right? Where they put in the time, learn the skills, and accelerate. So I think it's a phenomenally good time to be an entrepreneur, because you can self-educate. You can sample very, very easily what worked and what didn't work, because everybody that's out there that's a practitioner is putting it out on the internet. So I think that's been the biggest change, in my opinion, on the learning side. And the other thing I would say, obviously, which has been written about and talked about a lot, that the resources needed to really stand up a startup company is like 100 times less than what when I was an entrepreneur. I mean, you can get compute and computers and, you know, infrastructure to start writing software. It's super cheap. with Amazon and Google, et cetera. You can hire people globally. So, you know, when I was starting Octane, you know, for us to stand up a 10-person team was hard because it had to be a local network. Whereas today, you can hire globally, right? And the third ingredient in the mix, obviously, is capital. And I think that has become quite available as well with, you know, lots of concentrated seed funds. Obviously, you know, funds like ourselves that love early stage venture and have the tenure. But again, capital is also, you know, freely available.
The key things I walked away with is that these amazing entrepreneurs that you work with come out with hybrid skills. They are a mashup unto itself because by parallel pathing, learning multiple disciplines, integrating those disciplines into application, they've created this hybrid experience, but this mashup of themselves that is incredibly valuable to the company. And subsequently, you know, barrier to entry is low. So you have the ability to think globally and even act globally because you don't have the limitations anymore in finding the best talent. And in light of the pandemic, everything is virtual. So no one is precluded from finding amazing product people in Romania or other great talent from all over the world.
Yep. Very, very correct.
So do you feel entrepreneurship is thriving more during the pandemic? Because it's forced people to fundamentally think differently about creating opportunities for themselves.
I think entrepreneurs are always, you know, defined by a class of people that take advantage of the environment they're thrown into. And I think the same rule applies during 2020 when the pandemic is on. So, you know, it's quickly changed the landscape in which you have to build your company. And, you know, one of the key attributes of being a great entrepreneur or an elite entrepreneur is the flexibility and the speed by which you adapt. And so I think you're seeing the best entrepreneurial teams do just that. So I just got off a board call today, right before our podcast here, with one of my founders, a company based in Boston that has about 50 employees that have gone 100% virtual. These guys will never go back to a physical office again. Okay. And in doing so, they've been able to hire amazing talent outside of Boston, which was not the case in 2019 and 18. But it also comes with challenges. For instance, the conversation topic today we had was, how are we ensuring that the leadership team that we depend on stays glued on to the mission of the company, given that you're not seeing them on a weekly and bi-weekly basis? And we talked about that at depth. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that entrepreneurs will thrive and change the playbook. And the best ones are doing that right now. But I don't see the pandemic, you know, sort of slowing down the rate of entrepreneurship in any way, shape, or form. We've done at Sierra since, you know, earlier this year when we stood up the fund, I think about 21 investments, just to give you a sense of the crazy pace that, you know, entrepreneurs are still running at.
So what would you say is critical to consider for those looking to start a business in today's uncertain economic climate?
I think it's normally true just in general, but I think particularly in this era, this time that we're going through, I think there are a few things that are very important. I think the first is whatever idea or product that you're building, make sure it's an, you know, aspirin, not a vitamin, right? So this has to be a product or service that is, I gotta have this, otherwise, you know, my business would not work. It has really has to have a, you know, very, very fast return on investment for a customer that buys your product, right? So that's, I think, critically important in this climate. The other is, back to my earlier point that it's easy to start companies. I find entrepreneurs default to very niche ideas. So I'd mentioned to you before, one of the tenets of Sierra is that big companies are built in large markets or big markets. So choose the market segment wisely, which doesn't mean that on day one, you have to address the entire market, but make sure that you're playing in a market that is growing and is large so that by definition, you could build a large company. So that's the second point. And the third is that I think always focused on fundamental business milestones and metrics, right? Which is, you know, in a software as a service company, maybe it's, you know, your recurring revenue, your gross margin. What does your expense breakdown look like? What is your lifetime value to cost of customer acquisition ratios? So build a solid financial foundation, and I think that'll result in a great outcome. I find that many times when capital is more available, you remember, Connie, the kind of 99-2000, you know, the clicks were being valued and companies were going public. I don't want to see a market go back to that, those nonsensical metrics, which tends to happen when capital is available freely. So I always encourage entrepreneurs to keep the focus very cleanly on fundamental business metrics that matter. So those would be the few things for folks to consider during kind of COVID times.
I know we've chatted in the past where when there is scarcity of resources, it forces entrepreneurs to think differently and ultimately become much more efficient in the way that they operate, which in the end becomes certainly much more beneficial to helping create that traction. Because to your point, when capital is readily available, you are more likely to spend in areas in which may not be the wisest area to do so, and potentially not think as creatively about how to apply those funds in such a way that really help become laser focused on the business goals and objectives that you're trying to establish.
We've seen this in our portfolio. You know, when COVID hit in March and this year, there was, you know, suddenly the sky is falling response, you know, by the industry. And what we found was that the best entrepreneurial teams kind of really laser focused and got down to essential spending and cut everything else off. And it's a bit like, you know, you're going for a marathon and you lose 10 pounds and, you know, suddenly you're moving that much faster. And I think coming out of this pandemic, I think we're going to see, and we're already seeing much, much more efficient companies and company execution. So I think you're exactly right that when the resources are constrained, you know, people make very, very precise and non-sloppy decisions. And I think that's one of the benefits of being in an environment like we are in right now. Another analogy with a friend of ours is a winemaker, and he was telling us that in a drought year, you know, like 2017, the reason that's the best vintage is because the root of the wine has to go very, very deep because there's no water, and work much harder to get the grape. So the grape is very concentrated and makes the best wine. So another example of constrained resources results in kind of the best outcome. And I think that's another example of the situation we're in with COVID.
Yeah, what I start to think of is that it forces entrepreneurs as well as investors to truly think broad, because you have to be very strategic about the business, but you still have to dive very deep to make sure that you are extracting the most value and efficiency and productivity out of everything that you have. So you have to be very big picture. At the same time, you have to be very operational.
Correct. Correct.
Today's amazing entrepreneurs are always recalibrating because the world around them is constantly evolving. And in this case, during COVID, it literally is. You have to pivot, adapt, adjust, and reflect on what works and what doesn't. And as Tim said, it's being comfortable with changing the playbook, but also focusing on creating that solid financial foundation. But oftentimes, current and aspiring entrepreneurs can also get stuck. So what typically holds them back, or might they be getting wrong?
I think the biggest one I see is that entrepreneurs, and again, this maybe it also has to do with the fact that you're, you know, it's your first entrepreneurial journey. So there's nothing wrong about it, but it's just something to be self-aware of when you're starting down the entrepreneurial journey, first time, second time, third time, whatever the case might be. And I say this from experience because I look back at, you know, my skill set as an entrepreneur when I was at Scopus. And then I look at my experience when I was CEO and founder at Octane. And now I look at myself, 18 years in the venture business, being on many, many boards and taking many companies public. And in a way, if I grade, you know, the Tim Guleri of 1992, 1995, today I would give that person like a, not a failing grade, but maybe like a B minus, right? Because I'm like, I'm shocked how raw you were, right? Because these things are just learned skills, and you have to practice and perfect them, right, over time. So I think the single biggest thing I would say that entrepreneurs get wrong is they think too myopically, right? And they're not thinking through what the end goal or the end state of the business could be. And what I try to educate these founders on is that if you think through like a 10-year journey as you're building the company, you have to remember that every software company or company in general is a financial product, right? And they get a little mad at me because every company and CEO loves the widget that they're building. They love the product, right? And it's all about the product, which is true. But product is merely a vehicle to, you know, produce great top-line growth and revenue and ultimate EBITDA, right? And so when you look back and think about the great enduring companies of our time, like companies like Google and companies, you know, that are really created these monster, you know, value proposition for investors over time, it's because they dominated the market and produced a very compelling financial set of statements, which ultimately the market, you know, embraced. And when they went public, the company has been given more capital to, you know, to grow over multiple decades. So what I tell entrepreneurs, and I tell them that if they don't have the financial skills to think through those things, then get somebody who can be a great partner to be able to help you think through those goals. But don't think myopically. Think about what market segments you're building these you know, companies in. Are those segments going to attract, you know, investors? If so, why? If not, why? Right? And how do you milestone the business to ultimately create a great financial product, which then can be hopefully taken public and then survive and thrive much after that?
I think of creating your business's customer journey.
Yep, that is very true. Customer journey is one way to look at it, and obviously, through the customer journey, you also can then start mapping how much would a particular customer spend with your business, and then how many customers can I get, and that spits out a financial profile, and that's how you connect the product instincts that, you know, founders have with the financial possibilities of the business that you're building. Because not every startup, quote unquote, deserves to be a standalone scale-out company. It will only happen if you know, you do a very methodical exercise on the finance side of things. And most entrepreneurs are product or sales-oriented as they come into starting a company. And sort of this finance side is a bit of a blind spot. And so I really encourage folks to be methodical about learning what that the aspect of the business might look like, because I think it'll serve them well. And it'll make them make different decisions today that ultimately will really help the business going forward.
Well, then that's also a great segue into a very complimentary question, which is, what else does it really take to break through and create the momentum for that startup business? And in addition, what would you say are important attributes that are things that you seek in those entrepreneurs that are barometers for success? You mentioned a few early on, but you know, if you could share that point of view on the business side of things and the people side of things, because you look at it from the left and right brain.
Both sides, absolutely. I think, firstly, I think it's a great question because it's a hyper-competitive market right now. Every idea or business segment has, 10, 7, 20 competitors. So it's a fair statement to say that any company that we would be looking at probably would have, you know, half a dozen to a dozen competitors, right, in different shapes or forms. We've always, as venture capitalists come into that into a segment or looking at a company with that thesis, right? That there's definitely going to be competition. So what I look for from an attribute standpoint, I think, is the authenticity of what's driving the entrepreneur, and hence the burning need to solve a particular problem, right? And the reason that's super important is because the entrepreneur has to convince many, many constituencies in the journey of building a great company, starting with co-founders and the initial team, to the initial customer set, to a set of investors. So if you're authentic in your pursuit of the idea, you're great at storytelling, which, by the way, can be a learned skill, and you're great at therefore then convincing people on why they want to come on the journey with you, right? So one is this whole authentic, like the why behind the business. I go really deep into that, right? And look at it from all different angles. I think the second is the ability to be willing to be very smart about the resources that you're going to be consuming to get the business off the ground, and how do you build an efficient company over time. So this is, again, and then VCs have different, you know, philosophies, and I'm not saying anything about my colleagues that think differently, but a lot of VCs have this mindset that let's just, you know, put a lot of capital and, you know, we shall take the hill. I think that's there's a right time and a wrong time to put too much capital. In the early part of a company's journey, having resources that are constrained, that make you make very critical decisions and choose very carefully. Because for every yes, you have to say seven no's, because you just don't have the dollars to deploy across everything. So being very methodical is super important. So having a mindset of efficiency and building a fundamentally strong business is second. And I think the third barometer I seek, which is a very personal viewpoint, is how self-aware is the entrepreneur and what is the humble factor, right? Like, I feel that A's hire A's and B's hire C's, right? So then the question really becomes, you know, what do A's look like? And, you know, what are the kind of people that will surround themselves with other outstanding contributors? And, you know, kind of this self-awareness is really important, because one can't be, you know, 100% in every dimension. So you got to know what you're not good at and where do you want to complement your skill set. And then being humble, as in always having a mindset that says, all right, I'm not the loudest voice in the room. I don't need to be the smartest guy at the table or gal at the table. And just kind of having a little more of a sort of a normal demeanor is the kind of people that I, you know, like to back, because those are the guys that really sustain, because you're not, the company is not a personality. It's actually the collection of the people that drive the company forward. And founders that are self-aware and humble attract a team, whereas, you know, the single person around which the entire company gets built, you know, it can still succeed, but it's got a higher probability of failure, kind of is the point I'm making. So those are the three things I look for in entrepreneurs.
Well, you said it comes down to kind of identifying, what does an A player look like? What would you say exactly an A player looks like? You talked about one, which you said that this perspiration versus inspiration, just some of it you just can intuitively sense in their tempo and their pace and knowledge when you interact with them. What other things would you say there defines that A player?
That's a hard question, right? Because it's got so many dimensions that you need to look for. So for me, I think of this as a pyramid, right? So at the base of the pyramid is there just some skills that need to be for that function that you're evaluating for. And in our case, it happens to be either the CEO or the founder that's walking through the door, right? So the base attributes are things like, you know, education and obviously the developed skill set if they happen to be working in a company. And also look for the progression in their career as an indication of somebody that's been respected by peers and has incrementally sort of, you know, made their way through, you know, the school of hard knocks, right? That they put in the time and they've been successful at the next, you know, level. So that's, I think, sort of, to me, that's just, you know, table stakes, right? For the A player. And then as you get into the next two, that's where, you know, you start to really, you know, sort of focus on the right brain sort of analysis, because now it becomes a lot more blurry in terms of, you know, what are the capabilities? How's this the kind of the elite entrepreneur? And I think the elite entrepreneur, in my opinion, is the one that now, even with those base skill sets, has these attributes of being humble and deep, right? Has these attributes of really, really good work ethic, because they believe in the idea, right? So the work ethic element becomes like super important for me, right? The art of storytelling, which is again a learned skill. And I've had founders, by the way, who did phenomenally well on the base of the triangle. But the minute you start evaluating them on the top of the triangle, fail miserably, because they cannot get the point across on what makes a company or the product special. And that has all kinds of issues, because you don't hire the best people, you can't convince the investors, you can't convince customers. So I think the art of storytelling and the art of being able to convey the deep conviction why this is a great idea or a company, being humble and self-aware, which lets you hire the best people, and just having that rigor and that work ethic are the three kind of main elements I look for. And I think when I find those, you know, I think I've, you know, my internal bell starts going off that, okay, this is somebody I can really back.
What I'm envisioning in my head based on that is it's hard skills. It starts off with the foundation of hard skills / hard requirements or certifications, but you have to have the layer of soft skills at the end of the day, and that EQ, yeah, which makes up the whole person. Yeah. And without the combination, yeah, of that, the individual cannot be the A player that you know is critical, yeah, to build the business to where it needs to be.
And no, Connie, exactly right. And I also, I think, because I've done this for so many years now, I also latch onto like weird things in an interview. So, you know, for instance, I was interviewing this sales VP the other day, and turns out from one conversation to the other that he was a D1 tennis player, right? And, you know, we started talking about that. And I mean, not that I, you know, it's the tennis that was interesting to me. It was the fact that he was a Division I athlete. And to me, when I go back to that respiration and inspiration in an individual sport to play at that level, there is no way you can play at that level if you don't have the, you know, I just crashed and burned, I'm going to boot myself up and go do it again, right? I know that guy, in this particular case, it's a guy, has that skill. So again, through the interview process, through getting to know these people behind the resume, right, is when these traits start to emerge. And that's what hydrates, for me, the top of the triangle. Which then, you know, lets me to either have conviction that this is an elite entrepreneur or not.
Creating that startup momentum has to come from a truly authentic place. As Tim mentioned, he looks for that core reason as to why someone would want to start their company in the first place. What is the burning desire? And what need are you truly solving for? The passion, purpose, and ability to tell a compelling story and paint the vision is key. Because as an entrepreneur, you're convincing others to come on the journey with you. And as a leader, self-awareness and humility are critical factors, because you need to know what you're good at and what you're not. So it's important to surround yourself with those who can compliment you. At the end of the day, it's the collection of people that drive the company forward, not a single person.
So how has your definition of career success evolved from your early days to now?
In the early days, I actually didn't think about it much, because I was kind of, you know, doing my thing, and I was young, and I was, you know, building companies and having fun doing it. I think to me, as I look back, successes, look, I mean, you could be doing anything in the world as long as I think you're happy doing it and you can, you know, you can kind of take care of your family and your needs. I think that's, to me, is success, right? It doesn't matter whether you're, you know, a tech entrepreneur or you're, you know, you're, you know, down the street from where I'm talking to you, there's a little restaurant, there's a Peruvian restaurant, which is phenomenal. And it's this, you know, just this gifted chef, and he and his grandma works in the kitchen, and has a girlfriend and sister are the servers. And that to me is success, because there's so much of joy in what he does. And he does it at an elite level, right? A restaurant called Guiso, Latin cuisine, just down the road from where I'm sitting here today. So I think it has to do with having fulfillment and having joy in what you do every day. And I think that becomes, you know, the ultimate criteria. I think the transitional criteria, you know, as you're going through this, is obviously if what you're doing can result in financial returns, that is a barometer. And when you get on the other side of the barometer, I think this satisfaction of never having worked a day in your life, which is what I told you earlier, is what I think is the probably the highest data point I look for. And when I find people saying that, because it doesn't feel like work, like it just doesn't, right? I'm pretty sure a lot of people in different areas or types of careers say that. But I think once you say that, I think you've probably achieved career success.
And to close, what's the best work advice you've ever received?
The best work advice I've probably ever received, I'll give you an A and a B, and both from my dad. And one was implicit and one was explicit. The implicit one we've already covered, which has to do with just watching him go through his life. He was in the army and he was in infantry, which is the tougher part of army. So, you know, kind of getting up and getting on with it and not being a crybaby and sort of, you know, sucking it up and putting in the, you know, the daily hours, which we've talked about a couple of times. I think that is the perspiration, inspiration point that we've talked about. That is the implicit advice, just watching him, right, that I've kept with me forever. I think the explicit advice he gave me once when I was probably a teenager was that the biggest skill that you can have in life is when you know how to read people. When you meet somebody, you very quickly can ascertain, you know, people are by definition very complex beings and have complex motivations and have complex demeanors and have many, many layers. And the ability to read the authenticity of a person, finding what the positive attributes are, somebody that you can work with or work for, I think that is probably a skill that is, once you have it, I think it stays with you for life and is very important. I think that's something that my dad had sort of mentioned to me, and I didn't quite understand it till sort of, you know, in my mid-30s. I was like, huh, yeah, he was actually right on. Because, you know, I think that's been something that I've just, you know, sort of focused on and I think I'm relatively good at. So those are the two pieces of advice.
EQ. That's how I summarize that one. And finally, what's the best way listeners can connect with you?
Listen, I'm 24/7, so I'm very available. And I consider it my privilege to give advice to entrepreneurs and learn from them, because I don't have all the answers. So I can be reached at Tim Guleri or tim@sierraventures.com. That's SIERRA. B as in Victor, ENTURES.com. Or you can DM me at Tim Guleri on Twitter. And obviously, I'm also on LinkedIn, Tim.Guleri. And I'm reachable on all those venues.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspective on entrepreneurship, which what's so critical for many to take away is always be sweating, always be curious, and always be trying.
That's right. Thank you for the invite, Connie. This was phenomenal. I really enjoyed this stuff.
Continuous learning and being comfortable at failing, no matter what, are not only important traits for aspiring and current entrepreneurs, but also ones that any working professional should possess. As Tim shared, you can parallel track your learning today. And in fact, you need to, because you have to constantly build your skills. And those skills need to include those all-important soft skills, because you need to be able to communicate your vision, your story, and bring others on the journey with you. It's not just left brain and right brain anymore. It's the whole brain. These tenets are some of the core trends I'm also seeing in general when it comes to the future of work and what drives career momentum. And as some of you may know, over the last few years, I've been collecting insights into the changing world of work and the evolving definition of career success. Throughout this time, I've heard from many people about the challenges they've faced in defining and aligning their purpose and passion in a way that leads to a successful and fulfilling career, especially now in light of COVID-19. So in my next episode, I'll share some of the results from a survey we did back in the summer of 2020 to understand how do professionals define a career? What does career success mean? And what do they feel they need to create that necessary momentum? And I'm looking forward to sharing more around my upcoming book, Building the Business of You, a system to align passion and potential through your own career mashup, which will be out in February. Work dynamics and career journeys have fundamentally changed. And what I've learned and experienced myself is that people want to build their work life on their own terms. That linear and singularly focused career model isn't relevant anymore. And in fact, for many, it feels like we're being put in a box, not able to bring our whole selves to work. In the end, we feel stuck in a system that rewards you for staying in your lane. Through the countless discussions I've had with clients and guests on strategic momentum, and through years of working with various companies, large and small, I finally realized what people need: a personal step-by-step guide that shows you how to break free. So in the coming weeks, as I polish this guide, I'm going to share with you how to escape from those traditional expectations and build a path that reflects your unique mashup. And we're just getting started. Thanks for listening to Strategic Momentum. To connect with Tim, you can email him at tim@sierraventures.com. Or you can DM him at Tim Guleri, G-U-L-E-R-I, on Twitter. If you've liked what you heard, please subscribe to the show and share this podcast with friends and colleagues. And of course, we always appreciate ratings and reviews. You can also get show notes, links, and more tips and advice from this episode at strategicmomentum.co. I'm Connie Steele, and you've been listening to the Strategic Momentum Podcast.